Welcome to Crosstalk Bullhorns, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. There appears not to be much willingness among the coalition of the willing. All the talk of a deterrence force for Ukraine is not deterring Russia. Also, Trump says he deserves a Nobel Prize. Well, why then is he spoiling for a war on Venezuela? To discuss these issues and more, I'm joined by my guest, George Samueli in Budapest. He's a podcaster at The Gaggle, which can be found on YouTube and Locals. And here in Moscow, we have Mark Sloboda. He's an international relations and security analyst. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. All right, let's start out with Mark here. As everybody knows, we've been on this program has been on vacation for a month. We're back in the saddle again. Very happy to do it. But during that month, a lot happened to me, and not much happened with this thing called the Ukraine Project. I mean, it seems like some kind of musical chairs and this security guarantees and claims that Trump said this and Trump said that. And then we just kind of go around and around and around. And where is this deterring of Russia? The war continues. So explain to me, like I'm a five-year-old, what's going on here?
Yeah, I think the Trump administration is on a carousel. I think you put it exactly right. I mean, it is fit for a 5 year old. We keep going in circular motions, right? With the Trump administration, the Europeans, the Kiev regime, they're just going around. How many meetings of the coalition of the willing where they try to hype themselves up into the idea of sending European, NATO member state troops to Ukraine. It reminds me, with no offense to hyenas, which are fascinating animals, of a group of hyenas trying to goad each other into attacking a lion. That's what I see it. Except in this particular case, the lion is a bear. And we've had the upteenth coalition of the willing meeting this week, and still absolutely nothing comes out of it. Why? Because the Trump administration refuses to provide them with the security guarantees that they want to provide security guarantees to the Kiev regime in Ukraine, because they can't do it otherwise. They're not going to put troops in unless they know that if Russia attacks them, the U.S. will then go to war with Russia. And the Biden administration wouldn't even give security Yes. guarantees to the Kiev regime in Ukraine, or to the Europeans in that particular instance in Ukraine, much less the Trump administration. So at the same time, there's no movement on the peace process because Russia refuses to budge from their terms, because they're winning the conflict and they continue winning the conflict every day on the ground. And the U.S. just can't accept those terms. And certainly the Europeans and the Kiev regime won't either. So they continue going around in a carousel, round and round, and Russia keeps advancing on the battlefield. And other than that, not much has changed.
You know, George, it seems like the only willingness within the coalition of the willing is the willingness to meet. I think that's the only thing that they all agree on here. And another thing, it's a linguistic issue here, or a narrative issue. If a peace is achieved, we don't know what those conditions would be at this point here. But if it's peace, then why do you need reinsurance and deterrence and all? I mean, peace means the end of hostilities, okay? So, I mean, why all this talk about security guarantees? Isn't the peace the security guarantee itself?
You're absolutely right, Peter. And this is something that President Putin pointed out at the recent meeting of the East Asian Economic Forum, where he said, well, if you move your forces in now, then we will take them to be combatants and therefore legitimate targets. If, however, you're planning on moving your forces into Ukraine after there's a peace, then what exactly are they supposed to be there? And they haven't quite worked this out, because ultimately the goal was always the same, which is a temporary kind of cessation of hostilities. The forces move in and regroup, retrain, re-energize Ukraine to start the whole thing up all over again in 2, 3, 5, 10 years' time. And that was always the goal. And I think Russia knows that that's the goal, and that's why Russia is not agreeing to it. And I think Mark is absolutely right. The issue of the security guarantees is a complete misnomer, because it's not Ukraine that's looking for these security guarantees. It's the Europeans looking for the security guarantees. They want United States to guarantee them. The United States will be ready to go to war on their behalf. If they get shot at, then the Americans will say, oh, well, these are our allies. Article 5 applies, and we have to go in and support our allies. It's obviously nonsensical. It's obviously a violation of the North Atlantic Treaty. And there's absolutely no obligation whatsoever on the part of the Americans to do this. But they are hoping to fool Trump by flattering Trump and, you know, paying obeisance to Trump with all this somewhat creepy rhetoric about daddy and you really, you know, revolutionized NATO. With all this talk, they think they can fool Trump into issuing them with these guarantees, because without that, there's absolutely no public support for moving their forces.
Well, haven't you noticed that, you know, it's almost kind of like an act of tribute? You know, we agree with President Trump's peace plan, but it's like, but we don't agree with anything else, any substance that is coming out of his administration. But they always have to, oh, they are very, you know, happy that Trump is doing this. But they're not. They're being obstructionist. Mark, you know, the way I look at it, I mean, on the one hand, you could say the Europeans are trying to wait Trump out. But I think you could also make the argument that the Trump administration is trying to outwait the Europeans, as you've always said from the very, very beginning of this conflict, that the conflict will continue on the battlefield until there's a resolution. So it's like both sides. It's a hot potato. Nobody wants to catch it. And you want to keep throwing it back to the other guy. And what's missing in all of this is Ukraine and Russia's security demands.
Yeah, right now, I'm not so sure that either one is necessarily intentionally trying to outweigh the other. Just neither one knows what to do. There's nothing they can do at this moment that will stop Russia. They've tried the sanctions. The sanctions have had no effect. 36,000 plus sanctions at this point, and the Russian economy is actually still in growth, and outproducing all of NATO put together, and in the munitions and military equipment needed for this military operation, some four times over, according to the NATO Secretary General. I think instead they are a kind of flummoxing around without a clue of what to do. However, I think there might be multiple layers to this coalition of the willing talk. I think down the road, when Russia is moving across the Dnieper River, moving on Kiev, moving on Odessa or Lvov, then there will be increasing pressure that no matter what, to put NATO troops on the ground to try to preserve some type of rump state, whether they're a human tripwire or not. But at the moment, I believe that the European game is that their continual talking about putting troops on the ground as soon as there is a ceasefire or as soon as there is any type of cessation of hostilities guarantees that there won't be, because Russia will never accept NATO troops on the ground. So this is their way of just putting a spanner on anyone within the Trump administration, be it Trump or Vance or someone else, who has any idea of agreeing at least partially to some of Russia's terms in either to try to wind this thing down and hand it over to the Europeans. Europeans don't want the U.S. to get out of this, and this is their way of guaranteeing that it continues, maybe till, Trump is out of office and someone more belligerently anti-Russian is at the helm.
Yeah, well, we'll talk about belligerence in the second part of the program. You know, George, it's very interesting as traditionally the United States was always against, and I'm going back to the Soviet era, of Europe importing Soviet, now Russian, energy. And it's amazing how things have shifted. Now we have this drum beat, you know, no European should buy, right? I mean, it was, they always accused the Soviet, oh, this could be a political weapon they could use against Europe. And now you have European officials banging their shoe on the table, and nobody should buy it. No one, it's, you know, as their economies go down the tubes here. I mean, it's really amazing. If you didn't go through the Cold War like, well, you and I did, this is fanciful, is that, you know, and the Russians always said, we just want to sell it to anyone that wants to buy it, George.
Yeah, it is very strange because, of course, this caused a great deal of bitterness back during the early days of the Reagan administration.
That's right.
When Ronald Reagan threatened the Europeans that, well, you know, we're going to have to rethink NATO if you're going to go on buying your energy from the Soviet Union. And one has to, you know, give note that the Europeans faced down Reagan. Reagan had to back off because they said, we're going to continue doing this. You know, that we need this for our economies. You know, we need this for our energy needs. But this time around, I mean, the Europeans are far more, you know, insipid and weak than they were then. And but of course, there's so much hypocrisy that takes place with this energy because, of course, they're always berating Hungary and Slovakia. And Hungary and Slovakia, you know, they're very honest about it. It says, yeah, we get our oil and gas directly from Russia, and we're going to continue to get our oil and gas directly from Russia. But you Europeans, you do the same thing. Just because you're not getting it directly, you're getting it indirectly through India.
And Hungary and the Slovaks get it at market value. That everybody else in Europe is paying a huge premium. Go ahead, finish it up. Go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, exactly. That statement, no one should buy Russian oil, there should be an asterisk and a caveat, a footnote at the bottom. Unless it is Russian oil rebranded as Indian oil, to which we paid a 2 or 3 times a markup value on, that is the key to, because nearly every European country is doing that. It's all political, geopolitical posturing. That is all it is. They all still need Russian energy. Now they're just paying hand over fist for it. They won't admit that, but everyone knows it's true. And the governments in Hungary and Slovakia have openly called them out for their hypocrisy.
Well, as I pointed out, as the economic fortunes of all of these European countries, particularly the France, as it's facing a government crisis, who knows where that's going to lead. Gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk Bullhorns, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle Germandu. We're discussing some real news. Let's switch gears. You know, George, what's very interesting is that on the one hand, you could say that Trump is breaking new ground. It's somehow, this is an interpretation of American first foreign policy. But then you could just equally say this is like Bush-Cheney all over again. And the reason why I think there's an important caveat here is that it's just resource allocation. I mean, the Americans are not leaving Europe. They just want the Europeans to do more. So, I mean, how do you look at this? Because we have Secretary of State Rubio, which I guess could be called the Secretary of State of Latin America, because that seems where he pops up most here. And then we had this really interesting article out in Politico, is that the administration is abandoning this, you know, pivot to Asia. You know, the China threat, quote unquote, is not going to be top of mind. How do you interpret this? I mean, or is it just like throwing everything against the wall and see what sticks?
I do, Peter, think that it's more like throwing everything against the wall and seeing what sticks. This pivot that they have now towards Venezuela is a continuation of Trump 1. I mean, the ousting Maduro became an obsession with Trump won. And the fact that Trump has continued with this shows that this is something he cares about. It wasn't, I mean, you know, then we thought, oh, it's all John Bolton, you know, it's just the neocons, this is their project. No, this seems to be a Trumpian project. And I think Trump sees this as an easy win. He thinks that he's going to succeed here, that this will be easy. You know, we don't know the extent of the corruption within the military in Venezuela. Maybe he can bribe some people to oust him. And if he pulls that off, I think that's how he figures. If he pulls that off, this will be hailed as an enormous victory for him. Of course, this whole drug thing is a fraud. I mean, this is absolutely, you know, a ludicrous thing. You know, all the reports that have been made about drug trafficking in Latin America, they all say Venezuela plays a minimal role in
all of this. And it's a Pacific Rim.
It's a Pacific Rim, exactly. The main coca producers, Peru, Colombia, Bolivia, not Venezuela. It's not it's not being transported through Venezuela. So the whole thing has been cooked up, you know, is nonsensical. But Trump is using this as a way of ousting Maduro. And so when he was asked, oh, is this a color revolution? Or is this a regime change? Or, oh, well, we're not really talking about that. So he's not going to say it. He's not going to use those words.
Well, Pete Hegg said, and the Secretary of Defense or War, whatever it's called now, didn't actually deny it. Go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, let's pull out big geopolitical picture on this, right? Joe Biden tried to take Russia out, right? He thought that he could provoke Russia into Ukraine, sanctions would crush it, that there would be regime change in Russia, and then they could move on to China. That didn't work out so well. Trump tried to bluff and carrot and stick the Russian government into ending the conflict in Ukraine on American terms, and that hasn't worked out either. Then they quick pivoted to Iran because Netanyahu sold them on a decapitation strike that they could take Iran out of the picture. That didn't work out so well. Now, you know, you've had the China hawks in the administration, right? You know, going, well, let's focus on China. China's the priority. Meanwhile, they're looking across the Pacific and going, oh, that military parade, man. China's looking pretty buff over there. China's looking pretty buff. You know what? The Pentagon's national defense strategy document that's being cooked up now, according to Politico, says that the U.S. is going to downplay its confrontation with China in the Pacific and Russia and Europe and focus on the Western Hemisphere and domestic security. And with Trump's deployment of the U.S. military against the American people in American cities, and that's now amazing, this nonsense drug up, this is, I think, retrenchment. I think George is right. They're looking for not only an easy victory, but they're retrenching to their redoubt to the Western Hemisphere, right? That's also what this talk about Greenland all the time is about. There's different currents within the administration, right? This is an American first current, I think. And right now, the people who advocate that happen to have Trump's ear, if only because all of the Russia hawks and the China hawks and the Iran hawks haven't given him any victories.
And he wins.
Trump likes wins, right? And so now they've shifted to this. Next week, they may be on to something else, right? But right now, that's where we are.
Yeah, George, and it doesn't hurt that Venezuela has the largest known oil reserves in the world, right?
No, it certainly doesn't. And that's why if he pulls this off, first of all, going after Maduro is an easy one just domestically, because he isn't going to have any real issues with anyone within the Republican Party, with anyone in his base. Rand Paul, he doesn't like it, but Rand Paul isn't really he's not really a Trumpian or a MAGA in any sense. So it's kind of easy for him because it's something that's popular. There's just no constituency for anyone to come in and defend Maduro. But I agree with Mark. I think with Trump, he could turn around and switch, you know, suddenly he'll be back obsessing about Putin. Oh, I'm very disappointed in Vladimir. You know, I'm going to give him 48 hours to change his mind and then, you know, I'll do who knows what. It was interesting that he sent out that truth about India, Russia, and China.
I'm going to preempt you, George. I'm going to actually read it, okay? I'm quoting the president here. Looks like we've lost India and Russia to deepest, darkest China. May they have a long and prosperous future together, end quote. Keep going, George.
Yes, a very interesting truth in which we try to sort of figure out what does he mean there? I mean, he's been kind of a little bit sarcastic. He's being ironic. Oh, well, we've really lost them. What a great tragedy. But there's also a sense in which he's accepting reality, which is, hey, my policy hasn't exactly been a huge success. And there have been alternatives. I mean, a shrewder president, a Nixon-like figure in the Oval Office would not have allowed this to happen. There was no reason whatsoever to have India, Russia, China, North Korea, and he touted his great relationship with North Korea, to have all of them together and Iran and the United States. So he's being sarcastic, and yet at the same time, he's acknowledging that maybe this policy isn't really working.
You know, Mark, it seems like a kind of a new imperialism or reintroduced imperialism for the Western Hemisphere, because, I agree with you both. I mean, I hate to say, but, you know, it's an easier win. I mean, we're talking about possibly a military conflict here, okay? But, you know, both of you are right. This fascination with decapitation, it seems to be the flavor of the season right now. All you have to do is take out Maduro and three generals and it's all over. I don't think it's going to be that easy, Mark.
No, I don't think it is. I have to say that the forces that the U.S. has assembled off the Venezuelan coast are not a invade Venezuela and take over. I mean, they can lob some tomahawks into Venezuela for all the good that will do. Well, that if he can just drop some bombs, can Trump declare victory again and go home?
He did that with Iran.
But I think Trump is seething. That he's not just sarcasm in those posts, but bitterness, loneliness. He's not the center of attention. What happened in China was the world without the West, without the U.S., without Trump getting together, and he feels isolated and left on the outside looking in. He complained bitterly about the leaders of Russia, China, and North Korea conspiring against the U.S., in a prior post. And this deepest, darkest China, what kind of mixed up colonialist, racist, bovine feces nonsense is that? He's confusing what? Africa? Conrad Heart of Darkness with China now? I'm confused. I think he's confused. I don't even know if he intentionally meant that. Probably not. It's just Trump's inner racist and colonialist emerging in that post.
Yeah, well, the redeployment of great power politics with the racist and neocolonial mindset here. You know, George, it doesn't hurt Marco Rubio to pursue this policy, because I think, as you and I have pointed out, Rubio is always saying, the president said, this is the president's, but when it comes to south of the border, that seems to be his purview. And I think we have to remind everyone, the Florida presidential primary in 2028, it's very important. Oh, my goodness. That's his backyard.
Yes, it is. And no doubt there's a great deal of nostalgia for the great days of Reagan, when Reagan was waging these wars against the Cuban, Nicaragua, Axis, and you know that was the real threat to the United States.
Yeah, but it didn't really work out that well.
It didn't. And then there was John Bolton. Didn't he talk about the triumvirate of tyranny or some alliteration? And that included Cuba, Nicaragua, and Venezuela. So this is a kind of nostalgia trip for the GOP. And I do think that if Trump, and I think it's quite likely that he will lob missiles into Venezuela, I think he will hail this as a great victory. I think, hey, this is fantastic. He'll probably get a pretty good write-up and a pretty good reports in the media. He will tout that as superb. You know, maybe going into the midterms, he'll say, well, this is really successful. I've done something no one else has. But there are other things that he can open up. The Iran, you know, he can absolutely open up the Iranian front at some point. But I do think that when he sent out that truth, he's kind of blurting something out. I mean, he's kind of thinking and he's blurting out, hey, this isn't really great. I mean, I'm supposed to be the center of attention. Everything is supposed to be revolving around the United States. And here are all these powers, they're gathering together. And they're not talking about me. They're not talking about this.
Well,
Maloney sitting in front of my desk. This is all people that just don't care about me.
Yeah, because he has no respect for them. I mean, Mark, isn't it Trump being kind of the midwife of the multipolar world by saying these kinds of things?
You know, Trump has talked a lot about how he deserves a Nobel Peace Prize. He seems to be really fixated on that because they gave Obama one. And I think I'm going to be controversial here, and I'm going to say that Trump deserves the Nobel Prize, the Nobel Peace Prize, not for ending 7 conflicts, which is complete nonsense in his made up of delusional world, but because Trump has brought India and China together, something that even Putin couldn't do unassisted, right? He has achieved this. Now, maybe not intentionally. Maybe that's, you could say, critics will say that this is blowback, unintended consequences from his provocations, but the results are what mattered. And we saw Modi hand in hand with Putin and Xi Jinping.
I think that's a brilliant observation, and I will steal it, I guarantee you. And I will cite you for it, okay? Gentlemen, that's all the time we have. I want to thank my guests in Budapest and here in Moscow. And, of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk rules.